submitting patches, hundreds of patches, 2 days before the release of the code, you know? That is, I would be fired from my job if I would have one in this industry, I mean the software industry. So I think there's quite a big gap, which is historical. I think that how code is made is somewhat different from the industry practices we have in creating something quite similar. This is one of my observations. And the other one is there was a project in Hungary trying to interpret municipal budget laws. So they wanted to, there was a company that was parsing the budget laws to see which municipality, when, how much money they have, how much they need to spend on what, and so you could have like a very accurate account of what kind of spending is going on from the budget itself. And it turned out that all of these laws are so conflicting that it's impossible to get any kind of accurate data out of these budget laws. That is turned out by data mining and text mining, because we're trying to create an accurate view of what kind of where the budget is at the moment according to the plan, and it didn't work out at all. And unfortunately, the company that was doing the parsing was also responsible for creating this data in an accurate way. And since this was impossible due to the conflicts, they had some problems and went to court because they were not considering this aspect when they signed the contract.
Yes, my name is Preet. I work for the Agriculture Committee in the Parliament. But previously, I worked for the Commission. And from 2006 to 2008, we did a small bundle of trial projects on behalf of the, requested by the Parliament, on what could be the use of IT for democracy. It was called e-participation. And that dealt with most of these subjects that you are researching. Researchers participated, but it was not research, it was trial to see what we are, what we can do. So for your research, if you haven't taken a look, maybe you could, and maybe you find something interesting, if nothing less than the contents.
Thank you.
I have a question on it's an old idea, or when I started to understand the relation between national implementation of directives and how they are made in Parliament, and the role of basically the relation between the official journal of the European Union and what ends up in national legislation. And I learned from different colleagues that different parliaments approach the implementation phase quite differently. In small member states, new member states, there was a lot of, you just appended whole directives at the back of the law, and that's how they became national law. And in other countries, it was an elaborate process through parliament and to find the ways you could adapt within the limits of a directive into national law. And with a linguistic approach or a computer linguistic approach, do you think it would be possible to get some kind of measurement of the differences between implementation processes in different member states, in that sense? Theoretically, all the language versions of directives in the official journal should be equal in content and meaning, and they should also be transposed so the meaning is preserved for the purpose of harmonization, making so that the internal market is actually completed in the sense that the rules are the same everywhere. So how is that achieved, through national implementation processes. Could maybe, do you think that would be possible to look at in that objective way, so you kind of get the, this is what the, this particular model would say about the, that process, the different national processes?
Well, in principle, yes. I mean, if you could gather all the underlying texts, first the directive in the various languages that is being presented, and then the resulting national legislation that is the end product in different member states from some particular directive, then of course you could do some analysis and try to assess to what extent this more or less copy-paste from the directive, or if it's substantially different. So I mean, you could do that on a textual level or a semantic level, and try to get some measurement and actually test it and then compare it and so on. And of course, then you could break it down to see, so you could see that these countries tend to do more or less copy-paste from the European Union directive, whereas these other countries tend to reinterpret it in their own way. You could see things like that. Of course, then you need to dig down with it because it's only a computational measure, of course. But you could also break it down in some levels, so say into different political areas. So maybe there are some department in some national department who like to do things their own way, whereas another department more or less do copy paste. So you could look at differences on various levels and see if that makes sense. So in principle, yes, it would be possible to do.
In practice, it's also possible to do. I don't have all 23 languages of Europe, but I support, well, Pippi Longstreet, not myself, of course, supports, well, even I speak all those three languages, actually, English, German, and Hungarian. And I've looked at the Hungarian legislation a bit from Pippi Longstreet's and matching texts point of view, and it turns out, as Eric referred to, Hungary is one of the countries that usually just waves through the directives. But then there are exceptions, like for example the Audiovisual Media Service Directive, which led to the media law from the beginning of this year. There's absolutely no, or there's very little overlap between those two laws, because the Hungarian media law has been expanded to a huge text, and you can only find small text in that. But this is already possible. If a text has been made through, you can see that.
I'm not a lawyer, so why possibly that could be useful in if you would be in court, that you could say in one country this particular sentence reads like this, and in other countries transposed in another way. So what's the meaning?
Hi, I'm George. I work for the Greens and the Civil Liberties Committee as an advisor. We should forget that I've had this question because there is a discrepancy in definitions, which is extremely important if you want to see the letter of the law in languages. And then, digging a bit into it, I found out that, you know, there's these late lawyers, linguists, who give a first, like when a text is vaulted, then you have the lawyer linguists who their job is to kind of fix a bit the language according to legalistic terms. And then it goes into translation. So the lawyer linguists are, let's say, I'm not sure if they're in all languages or not, but they look at the text and then it goes into translation. But then the translators, they don't have really any, so if the translators that kind of mix up then the terminology and the discrepancy comes up, because they're not familiar with the academic terminology, so then they translate what the lawyer linguists, let's say, kind of fixed up. But the lawyer linguists don't really see the, so, you know, so there's various elements or parameters that are involved in the system. So
basically, it's like a commission project. this is a commission project to monitor the implementation of the European law. That is unified and
checked by another team for spelling mistakes, and then it's checked again by the Royal Linguist before it is. But I think you can discuss in the workflow.
Yeah. Interface which means what you propose to do. So actually, there are terminologies which are checking that there's a one-to-one response for technical words. But this is even enforcing an automatic way. So actually, if there's a sentence which has already been translated previously in the past, this is reduced as a chunk. So this guarantees the consistency of translation among documents and all the yeah, this is strictly enforced. In, at least here in the past, I don't know what's happening in the council or in other institutions, but I mean, here it's done. I mean, they're actually not just for doing manually what, let's say, the system is not able to check. But I mean, there's a huge effort in keeping the consistency and try to assure
that. My impression is also that the official journal is all the language, the languages are it's correctly made.
Yeah.
So the quality is quite high.
I mean, of course, as long as you add steps, I mean, there must be problems. As long as you have if the chain is increasing, of interpretation, that must be a misunderstanding between. If the terminologist might make a mistake or the system might have a bug, okay, that might happen. So, but the system and the system is already in force since, I would say, 2006 at least.
Another project for how to connect people both inside, in this case inside the parliament, but it's with pretty long term some power tracker for different ideas of how to use free software to help working with the parliament. And this is a project rather the inside of the parliament and seeing how free software can help, and specifically in this case with email.
Yeah, so the raison d'etre of the European Parliament Free Software User Group is to try to see those of us who are using free software, how, to which extent you can actually continue to use that in your work. And since we have a lot of information available when it comes to processes and what A and other calendars are there, it's, for me at least, it has been, it's possible for me, I'm not depending on working on the desktop that's provided by the phone. So most of my day-to-day work, I actually use my laptop and I run a free software distribution for Debian. But when it comes to mail, that's the key. I think we all use mail 80% of the time of the day. And to kind of be able to use my mail client that is free software based, that is Thunderbird or another version of Thunderbird called iStar that comes with a Debian distribution. That has been difficult to do because the Parliament's mail service is basically Microsoft only compatible, and I'm not, well, Microsoft is not free software. So to get around that problem, we have tried to re-implement what you could say, maybe you could have expected that from the Parliament to provide IMAP access to your mail, but unfortunately this is not the case. So if we would have had IMAP, email over IMAP, that protocol, then it would have been much more easy to choose which mail a client you would like to have yourself. So the T-mail project is basically trying to create an IMAP interface from my side, from my laptop, to the T-mail server, and then the T-mail server talks to the Parliament's mail server and talks then over a reverse engineered protocol with the Parliament's Microsoft mail server. And Jonathan will explain a bit how it works on the technical side.
Right. So yeah, this is not a case of programmatic vendor lock-ins, as you heard about the amendment procedure where you get a Word document that is impossible to read or other such things. You get the problem of not being able to choose which email client to use. And yeah, just some things I observed when we started working with email this last year was that, I mean, internally you only have your one box, which is really slow and has Outlook, and there you should simply write your emails, and if you go away from it, you don't have the same access to your emails as otherwise, because the external access is only through a very limited web interface, or possibly if you don't access internal service clients, which does provide access to Outlook even if not at your desktop, but not in a very sufficiently good way. And the mobile access, when we started, was basically non-existent. Now you can get access through ActiveSync if you have a phone which is licensed to Microsoft. And if you're so lucky, then you can read your emails on your phone, but well, still that's also only a choice. Since you, well, then that becomes another variable with what mobile device you have. So this is basically just our attempt to make a solution to this vendor lock-in, because trying to get the Parliament to change anything, such a simple thing as, Exchange does implement IMAP and SMTP, it's just that it's disabled in European Parliament. And, well, it doesn't seem like anytime soon it will ever be enabled. So this is our approach to hacking go around it and make it accessible for anyone. So basically, the basic structure of email looks like this. The user can sit anywhere, doesn't matter if he's connected to the Wi-Fi here, the cable in his office, or at home. He connects to the T-mail service and gets his emails from there. T-mail automatically fetches all emails from the European Parliament, backs them up, stores them in a secure fashion, and when you send an email, it goes, you can see that in this image, but it goes transported through the T-mail server, translated into the obscure protocol of the web access, and well, sent as in the same way as it would have been receiving type in your desktop. And then we have a backup procedure and also user access to the backups. So you get some benefits. First of all, you get fully searchable archives of your emails, which you do get if you're in your office, but it's hard to get anywhere else in the moment. The data retention policies for emails seem to vary, and they change them over time, but basically they clean out the inboxes after a while. You of course have the choice of storing the emails as long as the user wants to. Another benefit is, of course, you can connect to multiple capital plans. I noticed, for example, at MEP offices, the assistant usually have, of course, at least his own and the MEP's email, and the desktop can only access one of them at a time. And that's, of course, a limitation of how it works. So through this service, you can connect to as many accounts as you have access to. Another benefit which I didn't list here is that there is a problem with the Parliament's implementation of authenticating emails and mailing lists, which means that almost any mailing list like Google Groups or such does not work with a Euro by Euro account. And with Gmail, you have ways to work around that, so you can get a mailing list and use it with your normal email address requirement. And that's just a few of the benefits. I'm sure other users will find other benefits to try it in their own workflow. Yeah, and of course, an important aspect with this, since we're storing emails from the European Parliament and basically tunneling traffic that usually goes directly to the European Parliament, is security. And what we're striving for is to have everything we do at least as secure as the policy from the European Parliament, which means that the full path of working should never be less secure than we've been. This is the most here. And that means, for example, that we avoid any manual handling of user data. So it's all, of course, all protocols are encrypted over TLS or SSL. We never have a manual intervention of passwords or similar. So everything is stored on the server, encrypted. I never have to see a single password. So that's important. And of course, we also for privacy and user control, letting the we never decide on the data. It's of course the user's data, and they decide if it should be stored, if it should be deleted, if it should be archived, when they want to encrypt it. So
I can make a comment there. I get the spam or emails that mark as spam, and I get the legitimate emails marked as spam quite often, and then you can unmark them. And after a while, I got this: you have reached the limit of the number of addresses that you say are not spam. And then I had to apply for increasing. So I think it was 50 email addresses, and then I had to apply for another 50, and those are now also full. So. I don't know why, but for some, I'm subscribed to quite a number of mailing lists, and on mailing lists people use quite different, so there are other mail clients out there and other variations of the mail, implementation of mail protocols. So quite a lot of legitimate emails are marked as spam. So I have now decided to, I have to archive also my spam folder so I can look through through the spam to see, so they don't get automatically deleted. So that was kind of an interesting feature that, for me, it's quite important to know that mails that have been sent to me, I actually get them before they are deleted.
On the more technical side, how we got to the current running solution, through, of course, available free software, lots of great projects. This is just a short summary of what's connected in the services right now. There's lots of varying licenses, all with varying degrees of freedom. And the user, of course, then connects to the proprietary Exchange server and gets their email. If there are any questions about this, just ask later about what we're doing more closely. And there's just a short summary of different projects and protocols used for different things. For such a simple thing as reading your email the way you want to read them, which should be also, just as you said with contracts, this should be something that, why doesn't the department already do this? Why don't they let their MEPs and staff use email from their normal working method? If you're used to work from computer buildings in a certain way, it's kind of hard to adapt to what they force you to use. And of course, another aspect that's important is open standards. That's what makes in this the point at all. The standards are open, well implemented in lots of different places, and generally, I mean, are well tested and well working as compared to Exchange. Yeah, I don't have that much more. Depending on what you want to know, open for questions.
I was wondering, the place where you store it, is this also encrypted? ZFS?
No, the storage emails themselves is certainly encrypted. But it's
so you can read it in the server?
Yes, but I mean, of course, they have to be readable at some point, since the user has to access them. But yes, the storage of the emails, the script change, should be not used for it, but yes.
Do the staff and members of Parliament have any kind of public key encryption possibilities? Because then you could automatically encrypt everything on T-mail, and only the user of T-mail can decrypt it and read it. Basically, this is how my own email infrastructure runs. I have an incoming email server in Hungary, which automatically encrypts all the incoming emails that are not yet encrypted with my own private key. Not private key in that sense, but key that is just for this purpose. And then the encrypted email gets stored in Sweden, actually. And I retrieve my emails from Sweden in this encrypted form, and they get automatically decrypted on my local server or my local client when the private key is used that is only for the storage used. It's quite convenient, and I never care about my email being in Sweden and maybe confiscated or read it by someone because no one is able to read it, because by the time it gets to Sweden, stored there, it's already encrypted.
Right. As far as I've heard so far, no. They have no such infrastructure. And of course, providing it from my point of view would be easy for the user to want it, but it would be great if there was such a form of authentication for people working between parliaments. I agree, but as far as I know, someone can correct me, but I don't think there is one.
I get the impression from colleagues that have been working a long time here that you go to work and you sit in your office and you work on your computer, and that's where you are, and that's where you. It's kind of a. The mindset is not just what we are now used to, mobile, that you work everywhere, that you're mobile, you have your laptop, you have your cell phone. So I think the setup and the philosophy is maybe based on that people come to work and they sit at their own laptop, and then the need for that setup is kind of secure, or it's kind of by default quite secure. But now with the increasing use of private laptops and mobility in general, there is now a need for additional privacy and security measures that should be provided by the parliament by default. And I don't know how that is going, but I think that they are working on solutions in that direction. But with T-mail now, since I have my own mail client, I can encrypt my emails with PGP. Just like everybody else does or should do, and it's quite simple actually, and a bit fun, because when I encrypt my emails, all my emails when I send to colleagues, when they see them in their inbox, it's a little red, gets a little red guy as a symbol on each email. So people ask like, "Oh, I also want that little red guy." Yeah.
That's a great way to encourage signing. There's the red guys. People get
I don't know how using Outlook makes things secure in your PC in your office, because I don't know, not so well crafted spear phishing emails or targeted emails with specially prepared attachments, like in the case of RSA, for example, where there was the email was sent to some secretaries, and it was marked as spam, and it was stored as spam in the spam folder, yet one of the secretaries clicked on it, and that compromised the whole RSA secure ID token infrastructure. And having a monoculture of clients is actually a big vulnerability, I think. Having biodiversity increases also the survivability of the population. It's not only in biology, but this is also true for technology, I think. And if I know that there's only one client that I can attack, then it's quite easy to have a targeted attack. I'm pretty sure I will succeed.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I think that you also the Parliament's IT services here, they are doing what they can, and they look at the. And we have one representative here actually. In this, they pretend to protect the infrastructure in the house. And as it was built from the beginning, I think most of the communication was kind of thought to be internal anyway. But this is now changing, so there's a need to think about having a strategy and a policy that's based on open standards and that is vendor independent rather than this one big solution from one vendor.
Yeah, one question. How many people use it?
Total different trust have been increasing so far. But I presented this half year ago for a time. And there's been a lot of adapting to make it work with both the way that they delete emails and do two ways into the product. So when they delete emails, I delete emails. The user got this auto machine presentation to disappear. And there's been lots of small tweaks. And last time it was good enough for people to try out and use, and I think try it. And now I think it's a better experience than sitting at the desktop. So that's all.
Yeah, I think it's quite similar to. Yeah, almost as easy as if you sign up with the ActiveSync on your cell phone, you fill in your email address and your password, and so to try it out is quite simple if you're interested. Can talk to Jonathan about that.
We got maybe a question. So does it sync continuously? And then you see it when you connect and you see whatever is there? Or does it sync when you connect?
It syncs continuously.
Okay, so where is the user password? Because one thing that you have to do is that to give to Tmail your username and password, which is used for a lot of stuff in the Parliament.
Absolutely. Yeah, but of course this is the case either way. At some point, your password must pass the Tmail server. And the current policy is that I store it encrypted, and when I start the server, it gets loaded into RAM. So, of course, it does exist on the password on the server. In that respect, I think this is the way that you have to do it, because the generally I get the performance I can get with the access protocol that gets in your environment is about two emails per second. So if you connect once a week and you've got 4,000 new emails, you don't want to wait half an hour. So it has to be updated over time. And that means, of course, yes, the password has to be stored somewhere.
And that solution is hosted outside of the Parliament?
Yes, it is outside.
Okay, so you use only the web access or something?
Yeah. Yes, the web access It sounds like just a web interface, but it's actually a protocol itself.
I think it's a, if you compare with a mobile phone, I guess the phone would be the equivalent to the server, and you would have the same security question on how you secure that the password is not compromised on your mobile phone.
This is a dedicated server for the co-location local compared to a the iPhone OS running device with proprietary software running binary traffic to Apple once a minute storing your password on mobile VM.
So I don't know if you can ask that question, but does the Parliament's IT service know how Apple and other mobile providers store the password that's entered into cell phones? So in our thinking, I mean, that's how we were really trying to make it as to provide the same or preserve the security level of the Parliament so we don't compromise or risk anything beyond what's all inherently vulnerable.
And with the password change policy, where you have to change your password,
yes?
So I'm going to lock the password from remove because you try to sync and my password has just changed?
Yeah, when I try to sync, of course, when you change your password, you have to change it also in the single device for it to be able to continue to work. Otherwise, we'll try and fail and shut out. And then
okay,
no,
you're going to try and fail three, five, 10 times, and then it's going to lock?
It does lock it to 5 or 10 times.
Okay, maybe you should try.
Yeah, I it has been tried. Right now, the current way is that it will try a few times, and then my software will just try it for a while. And then try again. Fail. And the worst that ever has happened, I think, was the external login being shut down 2 hours or something, then coming back.
Okay. That was what I was talking about.
Yes.
And so you love the external.
But then it stops trying, so that's manageable. And of course, if the idea is that those using email actually actively use it, so then they will update the password there as well. And start functioning again.
Right. We were asked to wrap up in time, and we have now 1 minute to go. So I think we're perfectly fine now. I would say thank you for everybody who came, particularly you who came from the Parliament. I'm really happy to see that the activity is continuing, and now that there has been some substantial interest from all over the different parts of the Parliament. And a big thanks to all of the supporters that came and to the speakers, Steph and Peter and Jonathan. And please feel free to subscribe to EPSUG at epsug.eu. It's an open list, publicly archived, so don't say anything there that you wouldn't say in public. Which wouldn't be much, I guess, because we're a public institution and we're supposed to work here for half a billion European citizens. And we'll keep in touch and hope to see you at the next meeting. Thanks a lot.